cloth to clean up the man's face. "Savages," the Russian snarled. "Bloody, stinking savages. I'll throttle Major Vin for this, break his skinny little monkey neck." The Russian colonel sat down on the floor next to his American colleague and spoke from the heart. "Robin, we are enemies, but we are men also, and even war has rules. You serve your country, I serve mine. These people do not understand that without honor there is no true service, only barbarism." He held up the flask again. "Here, I cannot get anything else for the pain. I'm sorry, my friend, but I can't." And Zacharias took another swallow, still numb, still disoriented, and even more confused than ever. "Good man," Grishinov said. "I have never said this, but you are a courageous man, my friend, to resist these little animals as you have." "Have to," Zacharias gasped. "Of course you do," Grishinov said, wiping the man's face clean as tenderly as he might have done with one of his children. "I would, too." He paused. "God, to be flying again." "Yeah. Colonel, I wish..." "Call me Kolya." Grishinov gestured. "You've known me long enough." "Kolya?" "My Christian name is Nikolai. Kolya is a nickname, you say?" Zacharias let his head back against the wall, closing his eyes and remembering the sensations of flight. "Yes, Kolya, I would like to be flying again." "Not too different, I imagine," Kolya said, sitting beside the man, wrapping a brotherly arm around his bruised and aching shoulders, knowing it was the first gesture of human warmth the man had experienced in almost a year. "My favorite is the MiG-17. Obsolete now, but God, what a joy to fly. Just fingertips on the stick, and you just think it, just wish it in your mind, and the aircraft does what you want." "The 86 was like that," Zacharias replied. "They're all gone, too." The Russian chuckled. "Like your first love, yes? The first girl you saw as a child? The one who first made you think as a man thinks, yes? But the first airplane, that is better for one like us. Not so warm as a woman is, but much less confusing to handle." Robin tried to laugh, but choked. Grishinov offered him another swallow. "Easy, my friend. Tell me, what is your favorite?" The American shrugged, feeling the warm glow in his belly. "I've flown nearly everything. I missed the F-94 and the 89, too. From what I hear, I didn't miss much there. The 104 was fun, like a sports car, but not much legs. No, the 86H is probably my favorite, just for handling." "And the Thud?" Grishinov asked, using the nickname for the F-105 Thunder Chief. Robin coughed briefly. "You take the whole state of Utah to turn one in. Darned if it isn't fast on the deck, though. I've had one 120 knots over the red line. Not really a fighter, they say. Really a bomb truck." Grishinov had assiduously studied American pilot slang. "That's all right. It will get you out of trouble in a hurry. You sure don't want a dogfight in one. The first pass better be a good one." "But for bombing..." "One pilot to another, your bomb delivery in this wretched plane is excellent." "We try, Kolya. We surely do try," Zacharias said, his voice slurred. It amazed the Russian that the liquor had worked so quickly. The man had never had a drink in his life until 20 minutes earlier. How remarkable that a man would choose to live without drink. "And the way you fight the rocket emplacements. You know, I've watched that." "We are enemies, Robin," Kolya said again. "But we are also pilots. The courage and skill I have watched there, they are nothing like I have ever seen. You must be a professional gambler at home, yes?" "Gamble?" Robin shook his head. "No, I can't do that." "But what you did in your Thud?" "Not gambling. Calculated risk. You plan, you know what you can do, and you stick to that. get a feel for what the other guy is thinking. Grishinov made a mental note to refill his flask for the next one on his schedule. It had taken a few months, but he'd finally found something that worked. A pity that these little brown savages didn't have the wit to understand that in hurting a man you most often made his courage grow. For all their arrogance, which was considerable, they saw the world through a lens that was as diminutive as their stature and as narrow as their culture. They seemed unable to learn lessons. Grishinov sought out such lessons. Strangest of all, this one had been something learned from a fascist officer in the Luftwaffe. A pity, also, that the Vietnamese allowed only him and no others to perform these special interrogations. He'd soon write to Moscow about that. With the proper kind of pressure, they could make real use of this camp. How incongruously clever of the savages to establish this camp, and how disappointingly consistent that they'd failed to see its possibilities. How distasteful that he had to live in this hot, humid, insect-ridden country, surrounded by arrogant little people with arrogant little minds and the vicious dispositions of serpents. But the information he needed was here. As odious as his current work was, he'd discovered a phrase for it in a contemporary American novel of the type he read to polish up his already impressive language skills. A very American turn of phrase, too. What he was doing was just business. That was a way of looking at the world he readily understood. A shame that the American next to him probably would not, Kolya thought, listening to every word of his rambling explanation of the life of a weasel pilot. The face in the mirror was becoming foreign, and that was good. It was strange how powerful habits were. He'd already filled the sink with hot water and had his hands lathered before his intellect kicked in and reminded him that he wasn't supposed to wash or shave. Kelly did brush his teeth. He couldn't stand the feel of film there, and for that part of the disguise he had his bottle of wine. What foul stuff that was, Kelly thought. Sweet and heavy, strangely colored. Kelly was not a wine connoisseur, but he did know that a decent table wine wasn't supposed to be the color of urine. He had to leave the bathroom. He couldn't stand a look in the mirror for long. He fortified himself with a good meal, filling up with bland foods that would energize his body without making his stomach rumble. Then came the exercises. His ground floor unit allowed him to run in place without the fear of disturbing a neighbor. It wasn't the same as real running, but it would suffice. Then came the push-ups. At long last his left shoulder was fully recovered, and the aches in his muscles were perfectly bilateral. Finally came the hand-to-hand exercises, which he practiced for general quickness in addition to the obvious utilitarian applications. He'd left his apartment in daylight the day before, taking the risk of being seen in his disreputable state, in order to visit a Goodwill store, where he'd found a bush jacket to go over his other clothing. It was so oversized and threadbare that they hadn't charged for it. Kelly had come to realize that disguising his size and physical conditioning was difficult, but that loose, shabby clothing did the trick. He'd also taken the opportunity to compare himself to the other patrons of the store. On inspection, his disguise seemed effective enough. Though not the worst example of a street person, he certainly fit into the lower half, and the clerk who'd handed over the bush jacket for free had probably done so as much to get him out of the building as to express compassion for his state of life. And wasn't that an improvement? What would he have given in Vietnam to have been able to pass himself off as just another villager, and thus waited for the bad guys to come in? He'd spent the previous night continuing his reconnaissance. No one had given him as much as a second look as he'd moved along the streets. Just one more dirty, smelly drunk, not even worth mugging, which had ended his concerns about being spotted for what he really was. He'd spent another 5 hours in his perch, watching the streets from the second-story bay windows of the vacant house. Police patrols had turned out to be routine, and the bus noises far more regular than he'd initially appreciated. Finished with his exercises, he disassembled his pistol and cleaned it, though it hadn't been used since his return flight from New Orleans. The same was done with the suppressor. He reassembled both, checking the matchup of the parts. He'd made one small change. Now there was a thin white painted line down the top of the silencer that served as a night sight. Not good enough for distant shooting, but he wasn't planning any of that. Finished with the pistol, he loaded around in the chamber and dropped the hammer carefully before slapping the clip into the bottom of the hand grip. He'd also acquired a K-Bar Marine combat knife in a surplus store, and while he'd watched the streets the night before, he'd worked the 7-inch Bowie-type blade across a whetstone. There was something that men feared about a knife even more than a bullet. That was foolish, but useful. The pistol and knife went into his waistband, side by side, in the small of his back, well hidden by the loose bulk of the dark shirt and bush jacket. In one of the jacket pockets went a whiskey flask filled with tap water. 4 Snickers went on the other side. Around his waist was a length of 8-gauge electrical wire. In his pants pocket was a pair of Playtex rubber gloves. These were yellow, not a good color for invisibility, but he'd been unable to find anything else. They did cover his hands without giving away much in feel and dexterity, and he decided to take them along. He already had a pair of cotton work gloves in the car that he wore when driving. After buying the car, he'd cleaned it inside and out, wiping every glass, metal, and plastic surface, hoping that he'd removed every trace of fingerprints. Kelly blessed every police show and movie he'd ever seen, and prayed that he was being paranoid enough about his every tactic. What else, he asked himself. He wasn't carrying any ID. He had a few dollars in cash in a wallet, also obtained at Goodwill. Kelly had thought about carrying more, but there was no point in it. Water, food, weapons, rope wire. He'd leave his binoculars home tonight. Their utility wasn't worth the bulk. Maybe he'd get a set of compact ones. Make a note. He was ready. Kelly switched on the TV and watched the news to get a weather forecast. Cloudy, chance of showers, low around 75. He made and drank 2 cups of instant coffee for the caffeine, waiting for night to fall, which it presently did. Leaving the apartment complex was, oddly enough, one of the most difficult parts of the exercise. Kelly looked out the windows, his interior lights already off, making sure that there wasn't anyone out there before venturing out himself. Out the door of the building, he stopped again, looking and listening before he walked directly to the Volkswagen, which he unlocked and entered. At once he put on the work gloves, and only after that did he close the car's door and start the engine. 2 minutes after that he passed the place where he parked the Scout, wondering how lonely the car was now. Kelly had selected a single radio station, playing contemporary music, soft rock and folk, just to have the company of familiar noise as he drove south into the city. Part of him was surprised at how tense it was, driving in. As soon as he got there, he settled down, but the drive-in, like the insertion flight on a Huey, was the time in which you contemplated the unknown, and he had to tell himself to be cool, to keep his face in an impassive mien while his hands sweated a little inside the gloves. He carefully obeyed every traffic law, observed all lights, and ignored the cars that sped past him. Amazing, he thought, how long 20 minutes could seem. This time he used a slightly different insertion route. He'd scouted the parking place the night before, 2 blocks from the objective. In his mind, the current tactical environment translated 1 block to a kilometer in the real jungle, a complementarity that made him smile to himself briefly as he pulled his car in behind someone's black 1957 Chevy. As before, he left the car quickly, ducking into an alley for the cover of darkness and the assumption of his physical disguise. Inside of 20 yards he was just one more shambling drunk. "Hey, dude!" a young voice called. There were 3 of them, mid to late teens, sitting on a fence and drinking beer. Kelly edged to the other side of the alley to maximize his distance, but that wasn't to be. One of them hopped down off the fence and came towards him. "What you looking for, bum?" the boy inquired with all the unfeeling arrogance of a young tough. "Jesus, you sure do stink, man. Didn't your mama teach you to wash?" Kelly didn't even turn as he cringed and kept moving. This wasn't part of the plan. Head down, turned slightly away from the lad who walked alongside him, keeping pace in a way calculated to torment the old bum, who switched his wine bottle to his other hand. "I needs a drink, man," the youth said, reaching for the bottle. Kelly didn't surrender it because a street wino didn't do that. The youngster tripped him, shoving him against the fence to his left, but it ended there. He walked back to his friend, laughing, as the bum rose and continued on his way.
"And don't you come back neither, man," Kelly heard as he got to the end of the block.
He had no plans to do so. He passed two more such knots of young people in the next 10 minutes, neither of which deemed him worthy of any action beyond laughter. The back door of his perch was still ajar, and tonight, thankfully, the rats weren't present. Kelly paused inside, listening, and hearing nothing, he stood erect, allowing himself to relax. "Snake to Chicago," he whispered to himself, remembering his old call signs. "Insertion successful. At the observation point." Kelly went up the same rickety stairs for the third and last time. Finding his accustomed place in the southeast corner, sat down and looked out. Archie and Jughead were also in their accustomed place a block away, he saw at once, talking to a motorist. It was 10:12 at night. Kelly allowed himself a sip of water and a candy bar as he leaned back, watching them for any changes in their usual pattern of activity. But there was none he could see in half an hour of observation. Big Bob was in his place, too, as was his lieutenant, whom Kelly now called Little Bob. Charlie Brown was also in business tonight, as was Dagwood, the former still working alone, and the latter still teamed up with a lieutenant Kelly had not bothered to name. But the wizard wasn't visible tonight. It turned out that he arrived late, just after 11, along with his associate, whose assigned name was Toto, for he tended to scurry around like a little dog that belonged in the basket on the back of the Wicked Witch's bicycle. "And your little dog, too," Kelly whispered to himself in amusement. As expected, Sunday night was slower than the two preceding nights, but Arch and Jug seemed busier than the others. Perhaps it was because they had a slightly more upscale client base. Though all served both local and outside customers, Arch and Jug seemed more often to draw the larger cars, whose cleanliness and polish made Kelly think they didn't belong in this part of town. That might have been an unwarranted assumption, but it was not important to the mission. The really important thing was something he had scoped out the previous night on his walk into the area, and confirmed tonight as well. Now it was just a matter of waiting. Kelly made himself comfortable, feeling his body relax now that all the decisions had been made. He stared down at the street, still intensely alert, watching, listening, noting everything that came and went as the minutes passed. At 12:40, a police radio car traveled one of the cross streets, doing nothing more than showing the flag. It would return a few minutes after 2, probably. The city buses made their whirring diesel noises, and Kelly recognized the 110 with the brakes that needed work. Their thin screech must have annoyed every person who tried to sleep along its route. Traffic slowed perceptibly just after 2. The dealers were smoking more now, talking more. Big Bob crossed the street to say something to the wizard, and their relations seemed cordial enough, which surprised Kelly. He hadn't seen that before. Maybe the man just needed change for 100. The police cruiser made its scheduled pass. Kelly finished his third Snickers bar of the evening, collecting the wrappers. He checked the area. He'd left nothing. No surface he had touched was likely to retain a fingerprint. There was just too much dust and grit, and he'd been very careful not to touch a window pane. Okay. Kelly made his way down the stairs and out the back door. He crossed the street into the continuation of the alley that paralleled the street, still keeping to the shadows, still moving in a shambling but now exceeding quiet gait.
The mystery of the first night had turned out to be a boon. Archie and Jughead had vanished from his sight in a span of 2 or 3 seconds. He hadn't looked away from them any longer than that. They hadn't driven away, and they hadn't had time to walk to the end of the block. Kelly had figured it out the previous night. These overlong blocks of row houses had not been built by fools. Halfway down, many of the continuous blocks had an arched passageway so that people could get to the alley more easily. It also made a fine escape route for Arch and Jug, and when conducting business they never strayed more than 20 feet from it. But they never really appeared to watch it, either. Kelly made sure of that, leaning against an outbuilding that might have been big enough to contain a Model T Ford. Finding a pair of beer cans, he connected them with a piece of string and set them across the cement walk that led to the passage, making sure that no one could approach him from behind without making noise. Then he moved in, walking very lightly on his feet and reaching into his waistband for his silenced pistol. It was only 35 feet to cover, but tunnels transmitted sound better than telephones, and Kelly's eyes scanned the surface for anything on which he might trip or make noise. He avoided some newspaper and a patch of broken glass, arriving close to the other end of the passageway. They looked different close up, human almost. Archie was leaning back against the brown bricks of a wall, smoking a cigarette. Jughead was also smoking, sitting on someone's car fender, looking down the street, and every 10 seconds the flaring of their cigarettes attacked and degraded their vision. Kelly could see them, but even 10 feet away they couldn't see him. It didn't get much better. "Don't move," he whispered, just for Archie. The man's head turned, more in annoyance than alarm, until he saw the pistol with the large cylinder screwed onto the end. His eyes flickered to his lieutenant, who was still facing the wrong way, humming some song or other, waiting for a customer who would never come. Kelly handled the notification. "Hey." Still a whisper, but enough to carry over the diminishing street sounds. Jughead turned and saw the gun aimed at his employer's head. He froze without being bidden. Archie had the gun and the money and most of the drugs. He also saw Kelly's hand wave him in, and not knowing what else to do, he approached. "Business good tonight?" Kelly asked. "Fair enough," Archie responded quietly. "What you want?" "Now what do you suppose?" Kelly asked with a smile. "You a cop?" Jughead asked, rather stupidly, the other two thought. "No, I'm not here to arrest anybody." He motioned with his hand. "In the tunnel. Face down, quick." Kelly let them go in 10 feet or so, just enough to be lost to outside view. Not so far that he didn't have some exterior light to see by. First he searched them for weapons. Archie had a rusty .32 revolver that went into a pocket. Kelly next took the electrical wire from around his waist and wrapped it tightly around both sets of hands. Then he rolled them over. "You boys have been very cooperative." "You better never come back here, man," Archie informed him, hardly realizing that he hadn't been robbed at all. Jug nodded and muttered. The response puzzled both of them. "Actually, I need your help." "What with?" Archie asked. "Looking for a guy. Name of Billy. Drives a red Roadrunner." "What, you dick in my ass?" Archie asked in rather a disgusted voice. "Answer the question, please," Kelly said reasonably. "You get your fucking ass out of here," Archie suggested spitefully. Kelly turned the gun slightly and fired 2 rounds into Jug's head. The body spasmed violently and blood flew, but not on Kelly this time. Instead, it showered across Archie's face, and Kelly could see the pusher's eyes open wide in horror and surprise, like little lights in the darkness. Archie had not expected that. Jughead hadn't seemed much of a conversationalist anyway, and the operations clock was ticking. "I said please, didn't I?" "Sweet Jesus, man," the voice rasped, knowing that to make any more noise would be death. "Billy. Red Plymouth Roadrunner. Loves to show it off." "He's a distributor. I want to know where he hangs out," Kelly said quietly.
"If I tell you that—"
"You get a new supplier." "Me," Kelly said.
"And if you tell Billy that I'm out here, you'll get to see your friend again," he added,
gesturing to the body whose warm bulk pressed limply against Archie's side. He had to offer the man hope, after all. Maybe even a little left-handed truth, Kelly thought. Do you understand? Billy and his friends have been screwing around with the wrong people, and it's my job to straighten things out. Sorry about your friend, but I had to show you that I'm serious-like. Archie's voice tried to calm itself, but didn't quite make it, though he reached for the hope he'd been offered. Look, man, I can't... I can always ask somebody else. Kelly paused significantly. Do you understand what I just said? Archie did, or thought he did, and he talked freely until the time came for him to rejoin Jughead. A quick search of Archie's pockets turned up a nice wad of cash and a collection of small drug envelopes, which also found their way into his jacket pockets. Kelly stepped carefully over both bodies and made his way to the alley, looking back to make sure that he hadn't stepped in any blood. He'd discard the shoes in any case. Kelly untied the string from the cans and replaced them where he'd found them, before renewing his drunken gait, taking a roundabout path back to his car, repeating his carefully considered routine every step of the way. Thank God, he thought, driving north again. He'd be able to shower and shave tonight. But what the hell would he do with the drugs? That was a question that fate would answer. The cars started arriving just after 6, not so incongruous an hour for activity on a military base. 15 of them, clunkers, none less than 3 years old, and all of them had been totaled in auto accidents and sold for scrap. The only thing unusual about them was that, though they were no longer drivable, they almost looked as though they were. The work detail was composed of Marines, supervised by a gunnery sergeant who had no idea what this was all about. But he didn't have to. The cars were worked into place, haphazardly, not in neat military rows, but more the way real people parked. The job took 90 minutes, and the work detail left. At 8 in the morning, another such detail arrived, this one with mannequins. They came in several sizes, and they were dressed in old clothes. The child-size ones went on the swings and in the sandbox. The adult ones were stood up, using the metal stands that came with them. And the second work party left, to return twice a day for the indefinite future and move the mannequins around in a random way prescribed by a set of instructions thought up and written down by some damned fool of an officer who didn't have anything better to do. Kelly's notes had commented on the fact that one of the most debilitating and time-consuming aspects of Operation Kingpin had been the daily necessity of setting up and striking down the mock-up of their objective. He hadn't been the first to note it. If any Soviet reconnaissance satellites took note of this place, they would see an odd collection of buildings serving no readily identifiable purpose. They would also see a child's playground, complete with children, parents, and parked cars, all of which elements would move every day. That bit of information would counter the more obvious observation, that this recreational facility was half a mile off any paved road and invisible to the rest of the installation. Chapter 16. Exercises. Ryan and Douglas stood back, letting the forensics people do their jobs. The discovery had happened just after 5 in the morning. On his routine patrol pattern, Officer Chuck Monroe had come down the street, and, spotting an irregular shadow in this passage between houses, shone his car light down it. The dark shape might easily have been a drunk passed out and sleeping it off, but the white spotlight had reflected off the pool of red and bathed the arched bricks in a pink glow that looked wrong from the first instant. Monroe had parked his car and come in for a look, then made his call. The officer was leaning on the side of his car now, smoking a cigarette and going over the details of his discovery, which was to him less horrific and more routine than civilians understood. He hadn't even bothered to call an ambulance. These two men were clearly beyond any medical redemption. "Bodies sure do bleed a lot," Douglas observed. It wasn't a statement of any significance, just words to fill the silence as the cameras flashed for one last roll of color film. It looked as if two full-size cans of red paint had been poured in one spot.
"Time of death?" Ryan asked the representative from the coroner's office.
"Not too long ago," the man said, lifting one hand. "No rigor yet. After midnight, certainly. Probably after two."
The cause of death didn't require a question. The holes in both men's foreheads answered that.
"Monroe?" Ryan called. The young officer came over. "What do you know about these two?"
"Both pushers.
Older one on the right there is Maceo Donald. Street name is Juju. The one on the left, I don't know, but he worked with Donald."
"Good eye spotting them, patrolman."
"Anything else?" Sergeant Douglas asked.
Monroe shook his head.
"No, sir, nothing at all.
Pretty quiet night in the district, as a matter of fact. I came through this area maybe four times on my shift, and I didn't see anything out of the ordinary. The usual pushers doing the usual business."
The implied criticism of the situation that everyone had to acknowledge as normal went unanswered. It was a Monday morning, after all, and that was bad enough for anyone.
"Finished," the senior photographer said. He and his partner, on the other side of the bodies, got out of the way.
Ryan was already looking around. There was a good deal of ambient light in the passageway, and the detective augmented that with a large flashlight, playing its beam over the edges of the walkway, his eyes looking for a coppery reflection.
"See any shell casing, Tom?" he asked Douglas, who was doing the same thing.
"Nope. They were shot from this direction, too, don't you think?"
"Bodies haven't been moved," the coroner said unnecessarily, adding, "Yes, definitely both shot from this side. Both were lying down when they were shot."
Douglas and Ryan took their time, examining every inch of the passageway three times, for thoroughness was their main professional weapon, and they had all the time in the world, or at least a few hours, which amounted to the same thing. A crime scene like this was one you prayed for. No grass to conceal evidence, no furniture, just a bare brick corridor not 5 feet wide, everything self-contained. That would be a time-saver.
"Nothing at all, Em," Douglas said, finishing his third sweep.
"Probably a revolver, then."
It was a logical observation. Light 22 shell casings, ejected from an automatic, could fly incredible distances, and were so small that finding them could drive one to distraction. Rare was the criminal who recovered his brass, and to have recovered four little 22s in the dark, no, that wasn't very likely.
"Some robber with a cheap one, wanna bet?" Douglas asked.
"Could be."
Both men approached the bodies and squatted down close to them for the first time.
"No obvious powder marks," the sergeant said in some surprise.
"Any of these houses occupied?" Ryan asked Monroe.
"Not either one of these, sir," Monroe said, indicating both of those bordering the passageway.
"Most of the ones on the other side of the street are, though."
"Four shots, early in the morning. You figure somebody might have heard?"
The brick tunnel ought to have focused the sound like the lens of a telescope, Ryan thought, and the 22 had a loud, sharp bark. But how often had there been cases just like this one in which no one had heard a thing? Besides the way this neighborhood was going, people divided into two classes, those who didn't look because they didn't care, and those who knew that looking merely increased the chance of catching a stray round.
"There's two officers knocking on doors now, Lieutenant. Nothing yet."
"Not bad shooting, Em."
Douglas had his pencil out, pointing to the holes in the forehead of the unidentified victim. They were scarcely half an inch apart, just above the bridge of the nose.
"No powder marks. The killer must have been standing, call it 3-4 feet max."
Douglas stood back at the feet of the bodies and extended his arm. It was a natural shot, extending your arm and aiming down.
"I don't think so. Maybe there's powder marks we can't see, Tom. That's why we have medical examiners."
He meant that both men had dark complexions, and the light wasn't all that good. But if there was powder tattooing around the small entrance wounds, neither detective could see it. Douglas squatted back down to give the entrance wounds another look.
"Nice to know somebody appreciates us," the coroner's representative said 10 feet away, scribbling his own notes.
"Either way, Em, our shooter has a real steady hand. The pencil moved to the head of Massey O'Donald. The two holes in his forehead, maybe a little higher on the forehead than the other man, were even closer together. That's unusual. Ryan shrugged and began his search of the bodies. Though the senior of the two, he preferred to do this himself while Douglas took the notes. He found no weapon on either man, and though both had wallets and ID, from which they identified the unknown as Charles Barker, age 20, the amount of cash discovered wasn't nearly what men in their business would customarily have on their persons. Nor were there any drugs.
"Wait, here's something." "Three small glassine bags of white powdery substance," Ryan said in the language of his profession.
"Pocket change, $1.75. Cigarette lighter, Zippo. Brushed steel, the cheap one. Pack of Pall Malls from the shirt pocket. And another small glassine bag of white powdery substance."
"A drug rip-off," Douglas said, diagnosing the incident.
It wasn't terribly professional, but it was pretty obvious.
"Monroe?"
"Yes, sir."
The young officer would never stop being a Marine. Nearly everything he said, Douglas noted, had "sir" attached to it.
"Our friends Barker and Donald. Experienced pushers?"
"Juju's been around since I've been in the district, sir. I've never heard of anybody messing with him."
"No signs of a fight on the hands," Ryan said after turning them over. "Hands are tied up with electrical wire, copper wire, white insulation, trademark on it. Can't read it yet. No obvious signs of a struggle."
"Somebody got Juju."
It was Mark Charon, who had just arrived.
"I had a case running on that fuck, too."
"Two exit wounds back of Mr. Donald's head," Ryan went on, annoyed at the interruption. "I expect we'll find the bullet somewhere at the bottom of this lake," he added sourly.
"Forget ballistics," Douglas grunted.
That wasn't unusual with the .22. First of all, the bullet was made of soft lead, and was so easily deformed that the striations imparted by the rifling of the gun barrel were most often impossible to identify. Second, the little .22 had a lot of penetrating power, more even than a .45, and often ended up splattering itself on some object beyond the victim. In this case, the cement of the walkway.
"Well, tell me about him," Ryan ordered.
"Major street pusher, big clientele. Drives a nice red caddy," Charon added.
"Pretty smart one, too."
"Not anymore. His brain got homogenized about 6 hours ago."
"Rip?"
Charon asked.
Douglas answered,
"Looks that way. No gun, no drugs or money to speak of. Whoever did it knew their business. Looks real professional, Em. This wasn't some junkie who got lucky."
"I'd have to say that's the morning line, Tom," Ryan replied, standing up.
"Probably a revolver, but those groups are awfully tight for a Saturday night special. Mark, any word on an experienced robber working the street?"
"The duo," Charon said, "but they use a shotgun."
"This is almost like a mob hit. Look 'em straight in the eye. Whack."
Douglas thought about his words.
No, that wasn't quite right either, was it?
Mob hits were almost never this elegant. Criminals were not proficient marksmen, and they used cheap weapons for the most part. He and Ryan had investigated a handful of gang-related murders, and typically the victim had either been shot in the back of the head at contact range, with all the obvious forensic signs that attended such an event, or the damage was done so haphazardly that the victim was more likely to have a dozen widely scattered holes in his anatomy. These two had been taken out by someone who knew his business, and the collection of highly skilled mafia soldiers was very slim indeed. But who had ever said that homicide investigation was an exact science? This crime scene was a mix of the routine and the unusual. A simple robbery in that the drugs and money of the victims were missing, but an unusually skillful killing in the fact that the shooter had been either very lucky, twice, or an expert shot. And a mob hit was usually not disguised as a robbery or anything else. A mob murder was most often a public statement.
"Mark, any noise on the street about a turf war?" Douglas asked.
"No, not really. Nothing organized. A lot of stuff between pushers over street corners, but that isn't news."
"You might want to ask around," Lieutenant Ryan suggested. No problem, M. I'll have my people check that out.
We're not going to solve this one fast. Maybe never, Ryan thought. Well, he thought, only on TV do you solve them in the first half hour, between commercials. Can I have 'em now? All yours, Ryan told the man from the medical examiner's office. His black station wagon was ready, and the day was warming up. Already flies were buzzing around, drawn to the smell of blood. He headed off to his own car, accompanied by Tom Douglas. Junior detectives would have the rest of the routine work.
"Somebody that knows how to shoot. Better than me, even," Douglas said as they drove back downtown. He'd tried out for the department's pistol team once.
"Well, lots of people with that skill are around now, Tom. Maybe some have found employment with our organized friends."
"Professional hit, then?"
"We'll call it skillful for now," Ryan suggested as an alternative. "We'll let Mark do some of the scut work on the intelligence side."
"That makes me feel warm all over," Douglas snorted.
Kelly arose at 10:30, feeling clean for the first time in several days. He'd showered immediately on returning to his apartment, wondering if in doing so he'd left rings on the sewers. Now he could shave, even, and that compensated for the lack of sleep. Before breakfast, brunch, Kelly drove half a mile to a local park and ran for 30 minutes, then drove back home for another thoroughly wonderful shower and some food. Then there was work to do. All the clothing from the previous evening was in a brown paper grocery bag. Slacks, shirt, underwear, socks, and shoes. It seemed a shame to part with the bush jacket, whose size and pockets had proven to be so useful. He'd have to get another, probably several. He felt certain that he hadn't been splattered with blood this time, but the dark colors made it difficult to be sure, and they probably did carry powder residue, and this was not the time to take any chances at all. Leftover food and coffee grounds went on top of the clothing and found their way into the apartment complex's dumpster. Kelly had considered taking them to a distant dump site, but that might cause more trouble than it solved. Someone might see him and take note of what he did and wonder why. Disposing of the four empty 22 cases was easy. He'd dumped them down a sewer while jogging. The noon news broadcast announced the discovery of the two bodies, but no details. Maybe the newspaper would say more. There was one other thing.
"Hi, Sam."
"Hey, John, you in town?" Rosen asked from his office.
"Yeah, do you mind if I come down for a few minutes? Say around 2?
"What can I do for you?" Rosen asked from behind his desk.
"Gloves," Kelly said, holding his hand up. "The kind you use, thin rubber. Do they cost much?"
Rosen almost asked what the gloves were for, but decided he didn't need to know.
"Hell, they come in boxes of 100 pair.
"I don't need that many."
The surgeon pulled open a drawer in his credenza and tossed over 10 of the paper and plastic bags.
"You look awfully respectable."
And so Kelly did, dressed in a button-down white shirt and his blue CIA suit, as he'd taken to calling it. It was the first time Rosen had seen him in a tie.
"Don't knock it, Doc," Kelly smiled. "Sometimes I have to be. I even have a new job, sort of."
"Doing what?"
"Sort of consulting," Kelly gestured. "I can't say about what, but it requires me to dress properly."
"Feeling okay?"
"Yes, sir, just fine. Jogging and everything. How are things with you?"
"The usual. More paperwork than surgery, but I have a whole department to supervise."
Sam touched the pile of folders on his desk. The small talk was making him uneasy. It seemed that his friend was wearing a disguise, and though he knew Kelly was up to something, in not knowing exactly what it was, he managed to keep his conscience under control.
"Can you do me a favor?"
"Sure, Doc."
"Sandy's car broke down. I was going to run her home, but I've got a meeting that'll run until 4. She gets off shift at 3.
"You're letting her work regular hours now?" Kelly asked with a smile.
"Sometimes, when she's not teaching.
If it's okay with her, it's okay with me." It was only a 20-minute wait that Kelly disposed of by going to the cafeteria for a light snack. Sandy O'Toole found him there just after the 3 o'clock change of shift. "Like the food better now?" she asked him. "Even hospitals can't hurt a salad very much." He hadn't figured out the institutional fascination with Jell-O, however. "I hear your car's broke." She nodded, and Kelly saw why Rosen had her working a more regular schedule. Sandy looked very tired, her fair skin sallow, with puffy dark patches under both eyes. "Something with the starter, wiring. It's in the shop." Kelly stood. "Well, my lady's carriage awaits." His remark elicited a smile, but it was one of politeness rather than amusement. "I've never seen you so dressed up," she said on the way to the parking garage. "Well, don't get too worked up about it. I can still roll in the mud with the best of them." And his jesting failed again. "I didn't mean..." "Relax, ma'am. You've had a long day at the office, and your driver has a crummy sense of humor." Nurse O'Toole stopped and turned. "It's not your fault. Bad week. We had a child, auto accident. Dr. Rosen tried, but the damage was too great, and she faded out on my shift day before yesterday." "Sometimes I hate this work," Sandy concluded. "I understand," Kelly said, holding the door open for her. "Look, you want the short version? It's never the right person. It's never the right time. It never makes any sense." "That's a nice way of looking at things. Weren't you trying to cheer me up?" And that, perversely, made her smile. But it wasn't the kind of smile that Kelly wanted to see. "We all try to fix the broken parts as best we can, Sandy. You fight your dragons. I fight mine," Kelly said without thinking. "And how many dragons have you slain?" "One or two," Kelly said distantly, trying to control his words. It surprised him how difficult that had become. Sandy was too easy to talk with. "And what did it make better, John?" "My father was a fireman. He died while I was over there. House fire. He went inside and found two kids. They were down from smoke. Dad got them out okay, but then he had a heart attack on the spot. They say he was dead before he hit the ground." "That counted for something," Kelly said, remembering what Admiral Maxwell had said in the sick bay of USS Kitty Hawk, that death should mean something, that his father's death had. "You've killed people, haven't you?" Sandy asked. "That's what happens in a war," Kelly agreed. "What did that mean? What did it do?" "If you want the big answer, I don't have it. But the ones I took out didn't ever hurt anybody else." "Plastic flour sure as hell didn't," he told himself. "No more village chiefs and their families. Maybe someone else had taken the work over, and maybe not, too." Sandy watched the traffic as he headed north on Broadway. "And the ones who killed Tim, did they think the same thing?" "Maybe they did, but there's a difference." Kelly almost said that he'd never seen one of his people murder anyone, but he couldn't say that anymore, could he?
"But if everybody believes that, then where are we? It's not like diseases. You fight against things that hurt everybody. No politics and lying. We're not killing people. That's why I do this work, John."
"Sandy, 30 years ago there was a guy named Hitler who got his rocks off killing people like Sam and Sarah just because of what their goddamn names were. He had to be killed, and he was. Too damn late, but he was. Wasn't that a simple enough lesson?"
"We have problems enough right here," she pointed out.
That was obvious from the sidewalks they passed, for Johns Hopkins was not in a comfortable neighborhood. "I know that, remember?" That statement deflated her.
"I'm sorry, John."
"So am I." Kelly paused, searching for words.
"There is a difference, Sandy. There are good people. I suppose most people are decent. But there are bad people, too. You can't wish them away, and you can't wish them to be good, because most won't change. And somebody has to protect the one bunch from the other. That's what I did.
But how do you keep from turning into one of them?"
Kelly took his time considering that, regretting the fact that she was here at all. He didn't need to hear this. didn't want to have to examine his own conscience. Everything had been so clear the past couple of days. Once you decided that there was an enemy, then acting on that information was simply a matter of applying your training and experience. It wasn't something you had to think about. Looking at your conscience was hard, wasn't it? I've never had that problem, he said finally, evading the issue. That was when he saw the difference. Sandy and her community fought against a thing, and fought bravely, risking their sanity in resisting the actions of forces whose root causes they could not directly address. Kelly and his fought against people, leaving the actions of their enemies to others, but able to seek them out and fight directly against their foe, even eliminating them if they were lucky. One side had absolute purity of purpose, but lacked satisfaction. The other could attain the satisfaction of destroying the enemy, but only at the cost of becoming too much like what they struggled against. Warrior and healer, parallel wars, similarity of purpose, but so different in their actions. Diseases of the body, and diseases of humanity itself. Wasn't that an interesting way to look at it? Maybe it's like this. It's not what you fight against, it's what you fight for. What are we fighting for in Vietnam? Sandy asked Kelly again, having asked herself that question no less than 10 times per day since she'd received the unwelcome telegram. My husband died there, and I still don't understand why. Kelly started to say something, but stopped himself. Really, there was no answer. Bad luck, bad decisions, bad timing at more than one level of activity created the random events that caused soldiers to die on a distant battlefield. And even if you were there, it didn't always make sense. Besides, she'd probably heard every justification more than once from the man whose life she mourned. Maybe looking for that kind of meaning was nothing more than an exercise in futility. Maybe it wasn't supposed to make sense. Even if that were true, how could you live without the pretense that it did somehow? He was still pondering that one when he turned onto her street. Your house needs some paint, Kelly told her. Glad that it did. I know. I can't afford painters, and I don't have the time to do it myself. Sandy, a suggestion? What's that? Let yourself live. I'm sorry Tim's gone, but he is gone. I lost friends over there, too. You have to go on. The fatigue in her face was painful to see. Her eyes examined him in a professional sort of way, revealing nothing of what she thought or what she felt inside. But the fact that she troubled herself to conceal herself from him told Kelly something. Something's changed in you. I wonder what it is. I wonder why, Sandy thought. Something had resolved itself. He'd always been polite, almost funny in his overpowering gentility. But the sadness she'd seen, that had almost matched her own undying grief, was gone now, replaced with something she couldn't quite fathom. It was strange, because he had never troubled to hide himself from her, and she thought herself able to penetrate whatever disguises he might erect. On that she was wrong, or perhaps she didn't know the rules. She watched him get out, walk around the car, and open her door. Ma'am? He gestured toward the house. Why are you so nice? Did Dr. Rosen... He just said you needed a ride, Sandy, honest. Besides, you look awful tired. Kelly walked her to the door. I don't know why I like talking to you, she said, reaching the porch steps. I wasn't sure that you did. You do? I think so, O'Toole replied, with an almost smile. The smile died after a second. John, it's too soon for me. Sandy, it's too soon for me, too. Is it too soon to be friends? She thought about that. No, not too soon for that. Dinner sometime? I asked once, remember. How often are you in town? More now. I have a job. Well, something I have to do in Washington. Doing what? Nothing important. And Sandy caught the scent of a lie, but it probably wasn't one aimed at hurting her. Next week, maybe? I'll give you a call. I don't know any good places around here. I do. Get some rest, Kelly told her. He didn't attempt to kiss her, or even take her hand. Just a friendly, caring smile before he walked away. Sandy watched him drive off, still wondering what there was about the man that was different. She'd never forget the look on his face, there on the hospital bed. But whatever that had been, it wasn't something she needed to fear. Kelly was swearing quietly at himself as he drove away, wearing the cotton work gloves now, and rubbing them across every surface in the car that he could reach. He couldn't risk many conversations like this one. What was it all about? How the hell was he supposed to know? It was easy in the field. You identified the enemy, or more often somebody told you what was going on and who he was and where he was. Frequently the information was wrong, but at least it gave you a starting place. But mission briefs never told you really how it was going to change the world or bring the war to an end. That was stuff you read in the paper. Information repeated by reporters who didn't care. Taken down from briefers who didn't know, or politicians who'd never troubled themselves to find out. Infrastructure and cadre were favorite words. But he'd hunted people, not infrastructure, whatever the hell that was supposed to be. Infrastructure was a thing, like what Sandy fought against. It wasn't a person who did evil things and could be hunted down like an offensive big-game animal. And how did that apply to what he was doing now? Kelly told himself that he had to control his thinking, stay to the easy stuff, just remember that he was hunting people just as he had before. He wasn't going to change the whole world, just clean up one little corner.
"Does it still hurt, my friend?" Grishinov asked. "I think I have some broken ribs."
Zacharias sat down in the chair, breathing slowly and in obvious pain. That worried the Russian. Such an injury could lead to pneumonia, and pneumonia could kill a man in this physical condition. The guards had been a little too enthusiastic in their assault on the man, and though it had been done at Grishinov's request, he hadn't wanted to do more than to inflict some pain. A dead prisoner would not tell him what he needed to know.
"I've spoken to Major Vin. The little savage says he has no medicines to spare." Grishinov shrugged. "It might even be true. The pain, it is bad." "Every time I breathe," Zacharias replied, and he was clearly speaking the truth. His skin was even paler than usual. "I have only one thing for pain, Robin," Kolya said apologetically, holding out his flask. The American colonel shook his head, and even that appeared to hurt him. "I can't." Grishinov spoke with the frustration of a man trying to reason with a friend.
"Then you are a fool, Robin. Pain serves no one, not you, not me, not your God. Please, let me help you a little. Please?"
"Can't do it," Zacharias told himself. To do so was to break his covenant. His body was a temple, and he had to keep it pure of such things as this. But the temple was broken. He feared internal bleeding most of all. Would his body be able to heal itself? It should, and under anything approaching normal circumstances it would do so easily. But he knew that his physical condition was dreadful, his back still injured, and now his ribs. Pain was a companion now, and pain would make it harder for him to resist questions. And so he had to measure his religion against his duty to resist. Things were less clear now. Easing the pain might make it easier to heal, and easier to stick to his duty. So what was the right thing? What ought to have been an easy question was clouded, and his eyes looked at the metal container. There was relief there. Not much, but some. And some relief was what he needed if he were to control himself. Grishinov unscrewed the cap.
"Do you ski, Robin?"
Zacharias was surprised by the question.
"Yes, I learned when I was a kid."
"Cross country?" The American shook his head.
"No, downhill. The snow in the Wasatch Mountains, it is good for skiing?"
Robin smiled, remembering.
"Very good, Kolya. It's dry snow. Powdery, almost like very fine sand." "Ah, the best kind of all. Here."
He handed the flask over. Just this once, Zacharias thought. Just for the pain. He took a swallow. Push the pain back a few steps, just so I can keep myself together.